I want to introduce David Buller, who's the next speaker. David, is, what's your title?
Program manager.
David is a program manager at BioLogos. I happen to know, although we didn't get a chance to talk, but I happen to know that he is in charge of a lot of very important things going on at BioLogos, which I guess you're not going to talk about now, but he's going to talk about the evolution of beauty, which I think that's probably even more far out than what I was saying.
Maybe so. All right, so if we're talking about the evolution of beauty, you might as well start with... this rather intriguing video of a bowerbird. It's not just that it has this amazing coloration, as you can see, but it's putting on a pretty beautiful display, too, for this visiting female, carrying this bright blue berry that's contrasting with its beautiful feathers. Has built this whole display area around the female here. And you can't but notice the rather drab-colored female that's standing there in this bower and watching things. What's she thinking? She's simply kind of evaluating some underlying genetic fitness that all of this beauty is indicating. Or is her response, her reaction a little more like ours? Maybe one of pleasure and delight in seeing this beauty. Last year, the Yale ornithologist Richard Prum wrote a wonderful book called The Evolution of Beauty, How Darwin's Forgotten Theory of Mate Choice Shapes the Animal World and Us. It was listed by the New York Times as one of the top 10 books of the year in 2017, and is one of three finalists for the 2018 Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction. And so this presentation, I'd like to briefly introduce some of the book's ideas and then highlight at the end some potential observations and takeaways that we might have as Christians in the science and religion dialogue. So the peacock. Charles Darwin wrote about it in 1860. The sight of a feather in a peacock's tail, whenever I gaze at it, makes me sick. Maybe not the reaction we have, but if you go back to what he was writing about at the time, you can maybe understand why. Darwin was writing to Asa Gray in that letter a year after he published On the Origin of Species. And in Origin of Species, he knew that something like this was a result of sexual selection and mate choice, but he had written in Origin of Species that sexual selection will give its aid to ordinary selection, by assuring to the most vigorous and best adaptive of all males the greatest number of offspring. So he would see this as an outcome, really, of natural selection still. But it's difficult to really work that out, which led to his struggle with this. So he'd described the potential evolution of the eye through successive stages for better light sensing and resolution. But what about the evolution of an eye spot? How would that evolve in stepwise successive ways when no intermediate forms of an eye spot do anything? What would be the selective pressure on that? And he knew, of course, of a great many other examples of extravagant beauty in nature that would seem hard to explain by natural selection. He talked a lot about the great Argus pheasant, which was similar in coloration to the peacock here. Richard Prum, in his book, talks at length about the manakin, which is extraordinary, beautiful, tropical bird, a number of richly varied species. He talks also about bowerbirds that live in Australia and New Guinea. They're not only beautiful birds, but they're also known for creating elaborately decorated courtship structures and display areas like these, including a curated selection of what you might call kind of found art. They'll go around and carefully organize certain colors, maybe find a bright green fungus and decorate this area, maybe smash a berry and paint part of their bower in this area. And Darwin struggled with how to explain phenomena like these. And by the time in 1871 that he published The Descent of Man and of Selection in Relation to Sex, he'd come to articulate a fuller understanding of how evolution works. And in particular, he postulated that sexual selection can operate as an independent mechanism, and sometimes even in tension with natural selection. He argued that beauty is selected for no other purpose than the enjoyment of that beauty. and that therefore sexual selection cannot be reduced to natural selection. He wrote in a lovely passage that, on the whole, birds appear to be the most aesthetic of all animals, excepting, of course, man, and they have nearly the same taste for the beautiful as we have. Birds charm the female by vocal and instrumental music of the most varied kinds. And Richard Prum, commenting on this passage, suggests that the bit of anthropomorphism in this language is not accidental. Because Darwin saw humans as being evolutionarily connected with other animals on the same tree of life, it was a natural extension to see their behavior and experiences as in some way similar to our own. But if you open up an evolutionary biology textbook today, you probably won't see sexual selection listed as one of the foundational mechanisms of evolutionary change, along things like recombination and mutation. It's not that biologists reject sexual selection, it's just that most biologists today do not see it as being fundamental. They would see it as being reducible to and an outworking of natural selection. This is the approach of strict adaptationism. Beauty evolves because it's adaptive. Beauty has no intrinsic biological value, only extrinsic value as some sort of honest signaling of underlying genetic fitness. So beauty says that I'm healthy, socially attentive, and free of debilitating parasites and diseases. And this isn't simply a contemporary response. The pushback to Darwin's views on sexual selection in The Descent of Man were immediate. Darwin's Victorian contemporaries thought that animals were not cognitively sophisticated enough to make evaluative aesthetic judgments, and this is known now to be incorrect. And in an argument that's been left behind for other reasons, a bit of male bias, his Victorian contemporaries argued that surely something as fickle as feminine preference could not affect enduring evolutionary change. Perhaps the most influential pushback to all of this came from Alfred Russel Wallace, who was the co-discoverer of evolution by natural selection. Prum cites a book of Wallace's in 1878, which described natural selection as neutralizing sexual selection. And Wallace wrote that the only way in which we can account for the observed facts is by supposing that color and ornament are strictly correlated with health, vigor, and general fitness to survive.
You know, we're all blanked out here.
I don't have slides for every part. So. In an 1889 book, Wallace wrote that in rejecting that phase of sexual selection depending on female choice, I insist on the greater efficacy of natural selection. This is preeminently the Darwinian doctrine, and I therefore claim for my book the position of being the advocate of pure Darwinism. Prum rightly points out the irony of criticizing Darwin for being insufficiently Darwinian. But nonetheless, this approach that Wallace had of reducing sexual selection to being nothing more than an outworking of natural selection has been a mainstream approach in evolutionary biology ever since, even though there has been increasing attention paid to the role of sexual selection in the past few decades. Many scientists still prefer the evolution of beauty to proceed by rational, objective, adaptationist logic, rather than to be driven by arbitrary, subjective aesthetic experiences and judgments. Prum writes that aesthetic evolution by mate choice is an idea so dangerous that had to be laundered out of Darwinism itself in order to preserve the omnipotence of the explanatory power of natural selection. Only when Darwin's aesthetic view of evolution is restored to the biological and cultural mainstream will we have a science capable of explaining the diversity of beauty in nature. So let's take a closer look at what Prum describes as this aesthetic evolution. He defines this as the evolutionary processes that are driven by the sensory judgments and cognitive choices of individual organisms. And these sexual preferences for beautiful traits may or may not be indicators of underlying survival value. And a key argument against the purely adaptationist view is that many aesthetic innovations seem to have no discernible connection with underlying fitness, and even seem to come with natural selection disadvantages. I think one of the strongest examples Prum cites in his books. His book would be The Club-Winged Mannequin, whose mating call is this strikingly unique, high-pitched, kind of violin-like sound that it makes. It produces a sound remarkably through stridulation. So this is the same process that you're most familiar with from crickets making a sound, where one wing is rasped very quickly over the other. But it's not really known in birds other than in this species. And in order to do this, the club-winged mannequin has not only had to evolve different wing feathers that are designed for stridulation, more so than for flying, but it's had to evolve thicker, solidified ulna bones in the wing to anchor these ultra-fast wing movements to affect the stridulation. This is the only bird in the world that has partially given up the beneficial adaptation of lightweight, hollow avian bones, and it has done so for the aesthetic innovation that it allows. Now, some evolutionary biologists counter-argue that it's the very cost of traits like this that make them adaptively beneficial. The so-called handicap principle argues that this costly signaling essentially declares to a prospective mate, I must be especially fit and healthy if I've been able to survive this long with this enormous tail dragging along behind me. You can't get beauty like this for nothing. But there are problems with this argument. For one, costly signaling might perhaps explain the cumbersome length of the peacock's tail in general, but how could it explain the complex beauty of, say, the eye spots in particular? If the only evolutionary reason for a display trait is its conspicuous cost, then why wouldn't sexual displays in nature be merely unidimensionally costly rather than being beautifully complex in the individual and infinitely varied across the animal kingdom? And the deeper problem with this handicap principle is that its own logic means that the magnitude of the sexual selection benefit for a trait would be tied to the magnitude of its natural selection cost. As a result, these two selective pressures would be canceling each other out, resulting in no net selective pressure to drive the evolution of a beautiful trait. And Prum argues that further adaptationist attempts to work around this difficulty are ad hoc and lacking in any sort of evidence. Even in examples less extreme than this, Prum writes that it's been surprisingly difficult for biologists to find correlation between an attractive trait and underlying good genes. And on a theoretical level, he argues that this aesthetic evolution view should be the null hypothesis, the default explanation, unless strong evidence for correlation between a display trait and underlying fitness can be found. For Prum, the burden of proof is on the adaptationists, and his arguments and the arguments of adaptationists are found to be lacking. So then, how might this sort of complex beauty evolve in the aesthetic evolution model? Prum draws on the work of Ronald Fisher, who in the first half of the 20th century postulated a two-stage mechanism for the evolution of beauty. In the first stage, there'd be sexual selection for traits that are some sort of honest signaling of underlying fitness or health. So far, this is what Wallace proposed in his pushback against Darwin. But after this, the key point is Fisher's second stage, where attraction to the display trait becomes a little bit of a runaway train, with increasing attraction for the trait itself that uncouples the trait from any underlying fitness that it may have originally evolved to indicate. This happens because of a positive feedback loop as a result of what is called genetic correlated variation, or covariation. As Prum summarizes, when females exercise their mate choice based on particular displays, for example, a long tail, they will also be selecting indirectly on particular mate choice genes, because they will be choosing mates whose mothers likely also had genes for preferring long tails. So exercising the selection reinforces the selection and the sexual preference itself, resulting in this sort of a runaway train building this trait to be more and more extravagant. Prum suggests that you can look to fashion to find a metaphor for how this sort of decoupling of a trait from fitness would happen. And that made me think of a rather different kind of jeans than we typically talk about in this context. So you could imagine that the double stitching along some of the seams in these jeans was made to increase the durability of the jeans. And then maybe the contrasting color of the stitching was given to draw attention to the durability of the construction there. But once you start reinforcing people to prefer this sort of design with dramatic contrast stitching, it's not going to be too long before you have options on the market like this, with much more dramatic contrast stitching. Jeans like this would be of objectively lower value, given their cost, since added resources had to go into traits that do not increase their utility. But for an aesthetically minded purchaser, they may nonetheless be of higher subjective value. So this is, in essence, what Prom and Darwin argued would drive the evolution in beauty, of beauty in nature as well, as desire for this trait becomes uncoupled from anything it might otherwise be indicating. So in the few minutes remaining, I'd like to highlight three observations that we might have considering this Prum's articulation of aesthetic evolution. For those of us in the science and faith dialogue, what might be some takeaways? Well, the first thing, I think, is this should remind us and give us a broader view of beauty, that there's more beauty in nature than what we alone can experience. I was thinking of an analogy from the arts here. The great actor and movie and theater director and art connoisseur Orson Welles once said, "I don't believe in literature that anybody can have taste so Catholic that he genuinely likes Joyce and Eliot and Celine. And yet many people accept all of them. I say there's a point where somebody can't really dig that other fellow if they dig this one. Our eyes, our sensibilities, are only so wide." Our eyes. In one sense, and one probably more literal than what Welles had in mind, this claim is straightforwardly true. Our eyes can only see a very narrow sliver of the electromagnetic spectrum. So we could look at a flower like this one on the left, and that's what we would see. But if we were to take a picture with ultraviolet film, we'd see this additional coloration of the second image. And so with animal like a bee that can see in the ultraviolet range, they would see the third image. A bird would see the fourth image. It would be simulated color-shifted depictions of that. So birds have colorations as well and markings that we can't see because they extend into the ultraviolet range as well. And whales and elephants often communicate in infrasounds that we can't hear. But not just our eyes, but our sensibilities. This gets perhaps a little closer to what Welles was talking about. If I were to go to an art gallery, there'd be lots of artists or types of arts that I absolutely love, and there'd be others that kind of leave me cold. But rather than dismissing the other ones as being not beautiful or not valuable, I'd probably benefit a lot more from going through the gallery with a friend with different tastes, so I could kind of see the works of art through his or her eyes and have a broader view through that. Similarly, maybe our fellow creatures on Earth can serve as our companions to see a broader range of beauty throughout the animal kingdom. You might find some birds more strange than beautiful. You might not love hearing the sound of a frog calling. But what if their mates do? Why not use the tools of science to try to see the world through the eyes of a bird, to hear the world through the tympanic membrane of a frog? After all, our eyes, our sensibilities are only so wide. A second observation is that it's not only beauty, but an appreciation and enjoyment of beauty that grows out of the evolutionary process and not simply from humanity. In this aesthetic evolutionary picture, after all, beauty and the enjoyment of beauty for its own sake necessarily co-evolve. You wouldn't have one without the other. And animals' aesthetic tastes are at times stunningly advanced. Many birds spend enormous portions of time and energy on aesthetic pursuits, far more than most humans do. The great bowerbird of Australia carefully arranges objects in its display area, with increasing size the farther you get from the display. So it creates the illusion of forced perspective, a technique that humans didn't develop in Western art until the 15th century. So in the case of forced perspective, it seems that birds likely beat us to the punch. In one species of mannequins, groups of 4 to 5 males perform an elaborately coordinated song and dance routine, so precise that it takes years of practice for the group to perfect together. Only the very best groups are good enough to satisfy a visiting female, and even then, only the male skilled enough to have ascended to the group's alpha status will get to mate. The biologist Michael Ryan sees processes like these as analogous to the work of a human painter or a musician. All three, he says, are creative processes. All of them surround us with beauty by probing deep into our brains to find out just what we will consider beautiful. Some Christian writers have sometimes described the appreciation of beauty as something distinctly and uniquely human, something perhaps supernaturally gifted directly to humanity, with some even connecting it to our status as bearers of the divine image. And similarly, Prum suggests that perhaps it was Wallace's particular way of affirming human exceptionalism that influenced him to reject Darwin's view on sexual aesthetic selection, as animals being able to do a version of this too. But if this aesthetic evolution view is correct, then our aesthetic sense has a long evolutionary history that has long preceded humanity. We could say that God has been preparing our aesthetic sense for hundreds of millions of years, baking it into the natural order and enriching the interior lives of millions of our fellow creatures along the way. And a final observation is that as Christians, when we talk about evolution, we can do so in a number of ways, and how we describe the theory certainly impacts the way others will see it. Survival of the fittest and nature red in tooth and claw are reductive descriptions that can give a negative cast to someone's understanding of evolution. Evolutionary biologists sometimes refer to the adaptive landscape, a theoretical construct to conceptualize the range of possible biological phenotypes and their relative fitness value. So for example, upright bipedal locomotion is a peak with high fitness value, whereas locomotion through some sort of biological wheels would be a valley with a low fitness value. By analogy, we might imagine perhaps a sort of an aesthetic landscape operating in evolution, of various forms and types of beauty, some more arresting and more glorious than others. The adaptive landscape is rather heavily constrained by natural selection, but the aesthetic landscape is often quite unconstrained, often simply constrained by the underlying neurobiology of the species. Especially in ecological contexts that allow for highly selective mate choice. It's constrained by what would tickle the fancy, perhaps, of a female selecting for a mate, or vice versa. An evolutionary biologist, Michael Ryan, in his 2018 book, A Taste for the Beautiful, describes a number of studies that have shown the animal brain in cases to be sort of a seedbed of latent aesthetic preferences waiting for the evolution of new forms of beauty that they will be compelled by. And so as a Christian, I would see evolution as God's way of filling the world with a dazzling diversity of life forms and of ultimately creating human beings to bear the divine image and fulfill a special vocation. But along the way, perhaps we can also see evolution as God's creative way of involving his own creatures in the creation, the artistic creation, and enjoyment of endless forms most beautiful. Thank you. Yes, to go with you first.
So, you haven't said this, but there's an additional component to beauty and survivability, and that is in theories of theoretical physics.
Okay.
And it's not, you have to play it very carefully, but if a theory is not beautiful in some sense, mathematically, imaginatively, people typically won't proceed pursue it because it will have by history and by experience, it usually doesn't work out well. Mm-hmm. So there's an element, it's not visual beauty in the same sense you've got, but it is a selector for which ideas are funded and which ideas are pursued. Yeah. Frank Wilczek talks about something like that.
Yes.
So Dave, that's a pretty good talk, a lot of fun. To make it even more compelling to a young audience, May I suggest you had another title? What did you talk about on a date?
I'm sure biologists can have the most interesting dates and conversations. I'm sure lots to draw on. Yeah, in the back.
I have a question. So I'm going to go out of my league on this.
Neither am I, so we're in good company.
Not all sexual selection, though, selects for beautiful organisms.
Right.
I mean, at least to my human, right? So sexual dimorphism isn't always a prettier male.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's a neutral thing. It's a difference in stripes in a dragonfly's wings, and sometimes it's something that to me doesn't look so great. So is that, in your model, sexual selection that hasn't progressed them to beauty? Or is that just they have a different taste?
Yeah, so it could be a bit of both. I mean, there would be a variety of tastes. There would also be, you know, sexual selection would never be operating in isolation still. Yeah, Mike has a good picture of beauty of a sort.
Yes, that was the case.
Right. But in any case then, so if sexual selection is not operating in a vacuum, then it's going to be pulled various other direction by natural selection pressures too. And so there could be quite a range of places along of finding an equilibrium between the two, of having, you know, relatively minor natural selection disadvantage but a major sexual selection advantage. And so things like dimorphism and size could be driven by to larger males in evolutionary context could be driven by male-male competition to mate. Prum also argues in some cases it can be pushed back from extreme size and strength dimorphism by female sexual selection to find less coercively threatening males. So there's definitely one piece of the pie that operates in some directions, especially in animals like birds, but even there it's going to be pushed and pulled by other constraints and selective pressures as well.
Keith, yeah. I think you're in
here. Just a real quick comment. It's a very interesting talk. I read most of Plum's book. I have a Pinterest board, endless forms, most beautiful. Just birds, thousands of them, most yeah. of the tears to look at.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Right behind him as well. Yeah, you.
Yeah, thanks. So to follow up on this right here, so I guess the problem I'm having is this idea of beauty is kind of this more subjective aesthetic idea.
Yeah.
So, you know, you started your talk with this visually dazzling display. So is there a way to uncouple the, I don't want to say baggage, but just the meme that comes with this idea, this human idea of beauty, with a more kind of rigorous biological, use the term runaway genetic train at some point?
Yeah.
Can those be separated so that it's not so much, well, this is beautiful, but that's not, so how does it work with the model?
Yeah, that's an interesting piece, and I'm not entirely sure about that. So am I right in thinking that it would, kind of what you're saying is it would be really helpful if we had some more objective way of defining and describing beauty?
The biological points are trying to make without
yeah.
attaching the human aesthetic term of beauty to it, because the point was made over here that, you know, there's got to be examples, plenty of them, that don't necessarily lend themselves to, wow, look at those beautiful birds.
Right. You know? And I think maybe the impulse is part of what has made this a hard sell for some biologists, is that it's easier if beauty, whatever it means or however we would describe it, is sort of an epiphenomenon of just trying to find more fit mates. But the fact that that would be much more straightforward and easy isn't really an argument that it must be true. And so, yeah, I'm not quite sure how to... The difficulty is, in some sense, the subjective experience or something, but it does still seem that there could be good reasons for thinking that just as humans have that sort of experience, animals have something similar that drives selection between, you know, several mate opportunities that would be equally as good, but they seem to be some draw to certain ones other than the other that don't really directly give them anything. Yes?
Yeah, we're going a totally different direction here. I'm a
sure.
botanist by training, so... There's obviously beauty in plants and flowers mm-hmm. and so on, but it might be harder to drive that in the same sense, because flowers aren't you know, choosing who to mate with.
Yeah.
There's going to be other organisms making those choices.
Right.
And so I suppose, I mean, do we see then bees, for example, or flies or whatever, are they making aesthetic choices too then?
Yeah, I think bees are something really interesting because it's, as you get closer and closer to humans, it's easier to imagine this as being some cognitive enjoyment kind of thing, whereas a very cognitively simple organism like a bee, it's kind of hard to say that it's an experience of beauty. So I think perhaps we could think of an experience of beauty as being on the same slider of cognitive ability that would underlie any other number of experiences.
Yeah, I mean, it even goes into invertebrates and stuff.
Yeah, right.
Where they are, I mean, maybe they're flinging the gametes out all over the place, and yet there's still some aesthetic differences there. So,
yeah. And you had your hand.
Yeah. Do you think it might correspond to the neurobiological capacity to perceive beauty? Because birds are one of the most cognitively developed neurobiological species on a different branch of the tree.
Right.
In the animal kingdom.
Yeah, I think so. And there's, one of the other books, the book by Michael Ryan I mentioned that came out earlier this year, got a little bit more into the neurobiology. And there have to be traits that are, or displays or something that are salient to the organism. So perhaps one thing that gets a display trait going is that it's a clear marker that you've got the right species and the opposite sex to mate with, two kind of ground rules that are important to reproduce. And but at the same time, the more engaging, let's say, birdsong is going to be one that has a variety that sort of keeps stimulating the brain in ways that don't get tuned out. And so, yeah, depending on what the brain is capable of perceiving and how, then the different ways of beauty evolving to prod that and stimulate
it. So sometimes you get beauty with absolutely no possible selective advantage. I'm thinking of those very deep sea fish that live in the dark. Mm. When you pull them out, they have incredible colors of all kinds. I saw this once on Discovery Channel. And the question is, how is this possible? Why do these deep sea fish have these incredibly beautiful colors, right? Mm. And it looks like the answer is it's just not selected against. Mm. So if that's true, then there's a evolutionary neutral process to produce beauty even in the absence of any possible. Hmm. Possible. There's no light down there, so it doesn't matter what color they have. So that's a whole other way of looking at it.
Some things derived just from the biophysics, like green plants, we think are beautiful, but the green is just because it's the spectrum and it has to be absorbed.
Yeah.
Those kind of things are at play as well. Yeah. You can't just put our own judgments on what's really happening.
Sure.
It's physics.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Plants. Maybe the same with the fish.
Yeah, it's just random mutations that produce these colors and nobody cares.
It happens to be colored. We happen to find it beautiful.
But then we go down and find the fish, so maybe there's a planet. Any other questions? Yes?
I mean, this goes back to your last bullet. Basically, I mean, the conscious organisms are making selections like this that influence evolution. And microorganisms have some kind of intelligence, not brain, but chemical or whatever. Where is that end? Where is in that spectrum?
Yeah.
Okay. This now ends.